Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
It would be unduly narrow of me to offer career advice without recognizing that a person's mental health issues may mitigate against following career advice. And I can tell them all day and all night, network, you know, here's how to be a great leader, here's how to interview for a job, whatever. Well, I'm going to make a bit of an attempt to remedy that this morning. Many people, even with garden variety rather than severe anxiety or panic attacks, depression, bipolar, whatever, have been dissatisfied with the conventional treatment. For example, an SSRI, like Prozac is the prototypical example of that. They also may always recommend, for the last 20 years, the recommendations haven't changed. The therapy recommendation is, five, 10 sessions with a cognitive behavioral therapist. Well, those sessions can be not only expensive, but inconvenient. You got to show up for your 1 hour a week at a time at the place of the therapist's convenience. And after all that, many patients feel the talk therapy was only modestly helpful. They may feel that the drugs took the edge off their problem, but it aren't worth the side effects, or that the benefit of the drug faded over time. They may feel embarrassed to be going to a therapist, even sitting in the waiting room, stigmatized, telling their friends or even loved ones that they're, quote, in therapy. Well, enter the app. There are apps now that you can access on your phone or your computer. Can they offer something to people with depression, anxiety, bipolar, panic attacks, that at least are useful enough that they outweigh the disadvantages of therapy and the drugs that I just outlined? After all, there is reason for hope, because they're not developed by just the shrink who your insurance happens to cover, but by a dream team of the aforementioned cognitive behavioral therapists. And the apps have individually tailored activities that are available to you with reminders 24/7, unlike your therapist. And they're in a visually pleasant and bite-sized format. And those apps are the ultimate populist delight. They cost next to nothing. For example, $4.99 for what appear to be the two most popular and well-reviewed apps, lots of positive reviews, MoodKit, and I think it's $3.99 for Pacifica, its major competitor that at least I was able to unearth. And then there are hybrids between the in-person and online called, like, Big White Wall, which offer an app, but also email and phone access to a live counselor as well as group support. A priori, those sound pretty damn useful, not to mention cost-effective and without the negative side effects. But how helpful are mental health apps likely to actually be? Well, with me to explore that is Dr. Michael Knabel. He is the chairman of the psychiatry department at Johns Hopkins Medicine Suburban Hospital. He is a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association and director of a sort of a consumerreports.com for mental health apps called cyberguide.org, PSY, like in psychology, cyberguide.org. Michael Knabel, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure indeed. Well, you mentioned that you were impressed, at least to some extent, with that hybrid of apps and live support called Big White Wall, which I believe is being pilot tested right here in Northern California by Kaiser Permanente. Tell me why you're at least intrigued by Big White Wall.
Well, Big White Wall has a lot of tools that the individual can use on their own, mostly designed to be used on the Internet, on their web portal, but can also be used on a mobile device. And so these are, as you mentioned, these are symptom trackers, these are reminders, ways to track one's progress and capability of handling stress and difficult situations. But then it also connects the user to a social community, so you become part of a social community of other users, and the users support each other. This is done in an anonymous way, but it's very popular amongst consumers and appears to be quite helpful. And then if the user sort of feels like things are getting out of control, as you mentioned, you can get access to an online therapist. And this company was so successful in the United Kingdom that the National Health Service began to pay for its services in large community mental health clinics across the UK. The company has just recently moved into the United States, and they're trying to enter the market and interest insurance companies like Kaiser in paying for their services so that people can have round-the-clock access. And, you know, as you started out by saying, you know, don't have to rely on, you know, once-a-week appointments and waiting around in waiting rooms to get the help they need.
At $175 an hour or whatever. Let's break that down a little bit for listeners who can't quite feel what these apps are like. You talk about a symptom tracker. Describe what does that mean? What is a symptom tracker?
Well, so for example, let's say you've been suffering from depression, and at the bare minimum, you would sort of give a daily rating of your mood. So you might rate your mood on a scale of 1 to 10. You might also enter journal entries about things that were happening to you that day, and that might include nutrition, it might include sleep, it might include how much you exercised, alcohol intake, might include you know, social contacts. And so you develop, to the extent that the user wants, you can develop this very complete record of your daily activities, and you can chart how your mood may relate to fluctuations in these other variables, and then the program will give you some guidance on, you know, if you have a particularly stressful situation with your boss or your spouse, you know, other ways to reflect on that, other ways you might have handled it. So the idea of the symptom tracker is you try to develop a relationship between the events in your life and the fluctuations in your mood or your anxiety level.
What I find particularly interesting is what you said, that the, you know, not only can you track the symptoms and what they correlate with, and you can track your progress in how well you're doing over time, but you said that there is, for a given symptom you're feeling or whatever, you can then click on something that would help you actually address the problem, as in, let's say, it is the workplace and your boss that's triggering, at least an exacerbation, that you can get guidance. So is that like customized, essentially, amelioration possibilities 24/7? Is that hype, or is that an accurate statement?
Well, I think the real customized thing would require the entrance of the live therapist, and so that's maybe not 24/7, but much more accessible than the typical therapist. But for example, you know, if you're having a panic attack because you have to give a speech at work the
right
next day, it may use typical cognitive behavioral techniques that are posted online. So for example, it would ask the user, you know, you're feeling really stressed, you have the speech to give, is your reaction necessarily the only one? What about some of these other possibilities? Is there a way to reframe this? Is there a way to look at this in a more positive light? Is there a way to think of anxiety as a beneficial part of preparing rather than necessarily a horrible negative that you have to feel ashamed about? So you can go through a lot of CBT-type exercises on the program. And, you know, and if you're really kind of at the edge of the, you know, at end of your rope, so to speak, you could then ask for a consultation with a live therapist. And you might not get it instantly, but probably within a day you would have it.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
You talked about that many of the users are happy about the anonymous social community support. So let's say there was that intermediate phase. Let's take your example. It's a lovely one. Let's say that they have a speech in front of their boss who's intimidating. Let's merge the two fears. And their anxiety level is up. They're not ready to want to talk to a therapist yet, but they want to use this anonymous social community support, was the phrase you used. How would they then go about using that?
Well, so you would, I think what the company calls it is you post sort of a brick on your wall, and you say, I have a speech to give tomorrow. I'm terrified. My hands are sweaty. I'm breathing rapidly, and you know people are going to think I'm foolish. And your community that you're a member, you may get, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 responses from other people who said, oh yeah, that happened to me. Here's what I did. I meditated, or I went for a run. Or you know, some other kind of calming, relaxing thing, or just an offer of personal support. Sometimes just the fact that other people realize that they're not struggling alone with these things. There's lots of other people who've dealt with these issues, makes them feel, you know, normalized, and, you know, they calm down and they do quite a bit better just from interacting with a group, just as you would in a group psychotherapy. You know, you sit in a circle with other people and say, yeah, that happened to me and it wasn't so bad, I got through it, and here's how I did it. So now that can happen online, and I think people really enjoy that part of it.
Right. You say your community. Do you form your own community? Are you automatically entered in a community? How do you get this network of people who end up being the support?
I believe it's you know, you can join, like, for example, an anxiety or mood sector, and then you can select people and ask them to join your network. And there's not a lot of detail about the person. But you can control the number of people that see your comments. And, you know, apparently the company has a way of monitoring all the comments, so in case someone puts something there that's really, really emergent,
hurtful,
you know, or potentially something that's really toxic or threatening to others, they would intervene right away.
Well, yeah, every bit of this makes eminent sense to me, and yet I noted with interest your use of the term, it appears to be helpful. What is the evidence or lack thereof for its actual helpfulness in reducing anxiety, depression, panic attacks, bipolar, etc.?
That's a very good question, actually, and I think the answer is we really don't fully understand the answer to that. And I would have to say, even though, say, for example, cognitive behavior therapy has been around for 50 years, we still don't really know the answer for that either. The company has data about what happens to its customers, and there are a few preliminary publications, but it's really never been tested in a large-scale trial. You know, like, for example, we would see in pharmaceutical studies with, you know, hundreds or thousands of people being studied and compared to another condition. Our hunch is that, you know, because it's an ongoing system of support and communication, it may work better than traditional therapy, but we don't know for sure.
This is the first thing you said that absolutely befuddles me. You would think that there are so many well-moneyed interests that really would love to know if this works because it's cheap. You would think insurance companies would want to know. You think the federal government, that's, you know, ever more people are covered under some kind of federal subsidy. You would think that independent entities like the National Institute of Mental Health would have 20 years ago, Big White Wall, I read in preparing for this session, has been around for 15 years. You would think that, and certainly the National Health Service in Britain, which has adopted it, you would think there would be absolutely rigorous, you know, studies. Why, in your judgment, can't have the magic answer, but why, in your opinion, have there not been a whole panoply of rigorous studies testing these apps?
It's an excellent question. I think the United Kingdom is ahead of us in that regard, and they have sponsored the studies that exist, and they convinced themselves that they should make it part of their National Health Service. In this country, you know, the funds have just not really been available for it. The NIMH is mostly concerned with basic science of how the brain works, and, you know, that's a very worthwhile enterprise. And they tend not to fund clinical trials, especially not of psychotherapies. They just don't do very much. There's another government agency called SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which, in my view, should be more interested in things like this.
We always hear in the media, they fund these absolutely absurd projects, and they won't fund this, which could be it strikes me from what you're describing and everything I know about the field. I do have a PhD in a related field. Would a priori think to be of enormous value. How could they be funding these little trivial projects and not something that has world-shaking potential impact?
Well, I mean, I happen to agree with you. There are many who disagree with me, but I think, you know, this absolutely should be the province of that agency. And, so Big White Wall is a commercial enterprise, and there's also a feeling that they should not be, you know, necessarily supporting the work of companies, but this is a it's a company that is just a little bit bigger than a startup. They don't have the money to do a definitive clinical trial, which might cost hundreds of millions of dollars to really know. And I think now it is becoming the province of the insurance companies. The insurance companies are thinking, you know, we have to contain our costs. We have to keep people out of the hospital. We have to, you know, we have to avoid these expensive visits 2-3 times a week with a therapist, and maybe this is the way. And they're starting to become interested and starting to look at this. I really don't know why it's taken so long.
Okay, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with Dr. Michael Knebel. He's chairman of the psychiatry department at Johns Hopkins Medicine Suburban Hospital, and he directs a sort of a consumerreports.com for mental health apps called cyberguide.org, cyberguide.org. And I want to go to the phones and invite you to call, but I want to let your listeners know you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko, and we're going to talk about these big programs like Big White Wall. That takes, you know, that's going to be bought, that's expensive, it's going to be bought by a Kaiser Permanente or some insurance company. But there are two apps that are under $5 each called MoodKit and Pacifica that I want to talk about. You know, I want to listen to what Michael Knebel's got to say about that. But I want to give out the phone number. If you, especially if you've had experience using a mental health app, I invite you to call to share your experience or any other perspective related to mental health apps. As I said at the top of the show focuses on career, but only a kind of low-level technician in the area of career counseling would simply help somebody with a resume and cover letter, tell them the network, without a recognition that mental health issues profoundly affect the ability, a person's ability to land a job, succeed a job, and et cetera, which is why we're covering mental health apps here. So your question or comment regarding mental health apps, especially as it might relate to your career, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Okay, so Michael, you are intrigued by two under $5 apps. One's called MoodKit and Pacifica. Tell us about those.
So MoodKit, which is, I believe, $4.99, you can download that on a Google or Apple device. And it's a self-directed cognitive behavioral therapy for either depression or anxiety. It's got several different sections that the user controls and can customize. And Pacifica, slight correction to what you said.
Okay.
Pacifica is $3.99 for the entry level, but to use the full program, it's a subscription of about $30 per year.
Okay.
So that's an ongoing cost. And Pacifica actually is
$30 a year, not a month, $30 a year. So it's
$30
trivial.
A year. Yeah. So still relatively cheap, you know, and a lot cheaper than going to a therapist. Pacifica is, let me start with MoodKit, is very soundly based in the science of cognitive behavior therapy. But when you go onto the app, it feels heavily text-based. You know, there's a lot of entering of text and reading text. Pacifica is much more colorful, game-like, intuitive, and sort of it goes more flexibly into mindfulness exercises and other things like that. So MoodKit requires the user to be a very kind of text, verbal-oriented person.
Mm-hmm.
And a person who likes, say, for example, working through a workbook in order to get better. And Pacifica is, you know, much more sort of tech-savvy and fun to use, although maybe the science behind it is not quite as rigorous.
Mm.
So, you know, it's a little bit of a comparison of two apps that I think are quite nice, you know, based quite soundly in the science and fairly easy and inexpensive to use.
Am I correct that they also have the same kind of components, or many of them, that the Big White Wall, that big, you know, the bigger program that's often more bought by an insurance company, don't they have a symptom tracker, and you can keep progress, and there's all kinds of tips and tricks and so on and so forth? Isn't that right?
Yes. I mean, I think that's mostly right, but they're sort of a little bit more couched in the language of CBT, for example.
Cognitive behavioral therapy. Yeah,
yes.
Go ahead.
Thought distortions, you know, and, you know, or what they call warped thoughts or automatic assumptions that the user needs to learn to challenge, and they have each app has a way of listing those and then coming up with substitute solutions to the stress or the problem that you're experiencing.
Now, I would imagine listeners listening to this are going to come away with the following. They don't mind text or workbook things if it's doable. If it's horrible, boring, long, laborious, they're not going to do it. You're saying that the science may be a little better behind that? Are you able to say that definitively? I really want to know for my listeners, what are the, you know, is it worth, is clearly the more tech, you know, beautiful interface and the decrement in the science so little that you should default to MoodKit, to Pacifica? Should you default to MoodKit, and if you can't deal with the rigor, go there? What's the takeaway advice for users? Potential users, or try both.
Well, you know,
they're cheap.
It's a good question, and I sort of hesitate to recommend one product over the other. I think MoodKit uses the language of CBT as it was developed by Dr. Beck at the University of Pennsylvania, and the user goes through this very kind of tried and true methodology. Pacifica has that same methodology behind it, but it doesn't use the exact language, And like I said, it's more intuitive and easier to grasp. It's a little more expensive. So, you know, the user would have to choose. If they really want to get the real product that was as it was originally developed and promulgated in the field, then they would go with MoodKit. If they want something that's a little more colorful, attractive, and not exactly in this language as the original product, then they would go for Pacifica.
I'm going to be, you've got to be a little more, I guess, statesmanlike. I'm going to make an advocacy argument, and you tell me if you buy it.
Okay.
Most people with a mental health problem have a hard time staying with things, so they need things a bit sugar-coated, and they don't give a damn whether the language is precisely what the originator, as though Beck had a monopoly on cognitive behavioral therapy. There's millions of good, very good cognitive behavioral therapists. Albert Ellis wrote a lot about cognitive behavioral therapy. Millions of people. So the purity of the original language is superfluous. Motivation is what is critical. We want a simpler interface, and the difference in cost is trivial. $3.99 for the basic version, so you can certainly try it out. $3.90, we buy a latte for more than that.
Right.
And $30 for a year of therapy when you're suffering from anxiety or depression or bipolar or whatever is nothing. So isn't really the smart rule, try Pacifica. If for whatever reason you're unhappy, then go and spend the big $4.99 and try MoodKit. Do you buy that analysis?
I think that's right. And I think, you know, the point that you raise about how do we make these things attractive to people so they'll stick with it until they're well is a really great question. So, for example, there may be people who are very studious and verbally oriented who love the workbook and they're going to stick with this and do it. But most people, especially people mm-hmm. with more severe forms of
right.
mental illness, have motivational problems
right.
and they're not. And that's where the interface, you know, maybe using these apps in some kind of interfacing way with real therapists, I think is more important. I still think there's no substitute for a therapeutic relationship with another human being, especially for the more severe forms. You know, the more milder forms, people, I think, can use these apps and other techniques and solve them mostly on their own.
What do you make of the counter argument that says, you know, in an era in which now mental health problems are covered to the same extent as physical health problems, and we're covering ever more people under insurance, the really good practitioners are filled. They don't have room.
Right.
And the one that you're likely to get, who's going to be covered by your insurance or you can afford, may not be some superstar. And is it really so clear that that level of person that you're likely to get is going to be superior to an app that was developed very carefully by a dream team of cognitive behavioral therapists?
Well, again, it's a good question. I think it depends on the individual. I think especially for severe mental illness, which mm-hmm. let's say is about 5% of mm-hmm. the total population of mentally ill, mm-hmm. they need lots of services from
yep.
really good doctors and really good therapists, and they need a lot of interaction with a variety of services in order to get well. People with intermediate levels of mental health issues probably still need to take medications, go to a therapist.
Sure.
People with mild forms, I think the day is coming when people can pretty much take care of these things on their own. Just as you can take care of high cholesterol and high blood sugar and, you know, poor heart health on your own for a long time, you know, before you get unhealthy enough to need specialists. Mm-hmm. So the idea that mental health care becoming self-directed is becoming increasingly accepted.
Of course, the big assumption, again, is you need high-quality doctors. You said, yes, if you've got a severe problem, you need high-quality doctors, high-quality interdisciplinary team or whatever, but access to that level of people. And people who are that troubled may not even be motivated enough to dig out, to fight their way to get to that great doctor and that great psychopharmacologist. So as a national solution, even at the fairly severe level, I'm wondering whether apps need to be looked at not in compared to the ideal, but compared to the what would otherwise have occurred in the absence of the apps. What do you think?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, another statistic that's always affected me deeply is the idea that there's 50 or 60% of counties in the United States don't have a single social worker, psychologist, or
wow.
So there are no services. So how do you connect people in those environments to a care team? And there's a growing group of businesses that we call electronic case management, where it's sort of like Big White Wall, but it's connected to a health system. And the patient enters daily, you know, what time they took their medications or how they're feeling. And if the ratings take a nosedive or if the patient fails to enter, then somebody from the case management team actually goes to the patient and tries to check out the situation and make sure that they're not in trouble so they don't have to get into a crisis and go to the hospital. So especially in those kind of remote locations locations where you can't get in to see somebody, I think these kind of solutions are going to be very important in the future.
Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest, Michael Knabel. What is your question or comment related to mental health apps for him? Hi, it's you.
Am I on the radio?
You are.
Yes, my name is Lynn in Berkeley. And first of all, I'd like to know how they came up with a Big White Wall or whatever it is as a name. That's curious. And secondly, my ex for 9 years has had depression. She's been in and out of the hospital numerous times, and when she's not doing well and she has an appointment at the therapist, she just doesn't go. And when she's doing well, she says she thinks, I think she does, that, oh, I don't have to go to the therapist because I feel great. And so the point being that just for her to physically get in the car and go to the therapist is a real chore regardless of how she's feeling. So I think if this could be done online, and I used to talk to a therapist on the phone when I couldn't actually go to his house, and it's not as good, but I think if somebody could do something online, it would get them to do it as opposed to getting in the car and driving, you know, to the appointment. So that's my comment.
Yeah, we'll have answer to both questions. Do you know how they came up with Big White Wall? And the caller was just reiterating our point about access and actual usage may be much higher in the typical low-motivated person with a mental illness.
Yeah, both very good points, and thank you for calling. I'm not sure exactly how they came up with the name Big White Wall, but I think the idea was it was sort of like a chalkboard or kind of a clean space where you could put anything that's on your mind up there, and it would be observed by your community and by the potential therapist. So I think the idea is, you know, this is a safe space for you to say what's ever in your mind, and you're writing it on a wall. And I think the points you raise about, you know, motivation, access to care are exactly what we're trying to solve with these technologies. And it's not just in mental health. It's also in the rest of it. We have tremendous difficulty getting people to take their insulin and their high blood pressure medicines when they say, I don't feel anything. I don't think there's really anything wrong with me. Maybe I can skip today. And really there, the solution is the therapeutic relationship between the doctor and the patient. And that's why I think that's still important, because what you have to do is you have to eventually get the patient to understand that it's in their best interest to work with you and that there's something in it for them. And it takes a while for people to get to that point. Can we do that in the online space remains to be seen, or does it still require a very, you know, human interaction with another person who's, gently moving you towards taking better care of yourself. It remains to be seen.
You know, regarding that assumption that a human being is more likely to engender motivation, I'm struck by Dr. Dean Ornish's study that found that 95% of people who had heart attacks and were told you change your eating habits or you die, and 70, or about 90% of them or something like that, went back within 2 years, were back to eating the way they were, and they were all under a physician's care. So
right.
The presumption that a live human being, especially doctors, and I do teach at the medical school at UCSF, and I know I see these future doctors and current doctors, and you know, they're not necessarily, they may be well trained in diagnosis and treatment, but they're not necessarily the greatest at engendering compliance. They're more intellectual than the average patient. So I would argue that a carefully designed app that really did create a kind of a combination of caring and fear and the balance of the two may be as or more likely than the average physician or even psychiatrist pushing psychiatrist to get the patient to comply. What's your analysis? What's your reaction to that?
I think that's right. I think, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, we'd be able to use all of these things and together to help the patient. And I think, you know, this is a bigger philosophical question, but you know, there's a tension in this country now between providing greater access for more people to health care, which is great, but it also then means that the amount of time that any individual provider can spend with the patient goes down, and the idea that you're going to come and have a nice leisurely chat and you're going to really know your doctor and they're really going to know you, you know, it's more elusive. I actually work in a setting where I have the luxury of really being able to spend as much time as I need with people, and but those days are becoming few and far between in our field now. So again, if we could have all of these things in our armamentarium, I think it would be quite good.
Yeah, realism is important. You know, the perfect is the enemy of the good, and we all tend to romanticize as we develop policy. We create these ideal worlds, and in the real world, things aren't quite the same. Now, I am fascinated by the fact that I did interview Tom Insel for Psychology Today. He just left as the head of the National Institute of Mental Health. And where did he go? He went to Google. So what do you know what he's doing at Google, or what you're hoping he's going to do at Google?
I don't know exactly, but Google is forming a subsidiary, which I believe is called Verily, V-E-R-I-L-Y,
okay,
in which I think they hope to explore this space. I think they would like to develop some of their own applications.
That makes sense.
And the one concept that we didn't touch on is, and it relates to patients' motivation and sticking to these. There is the potential to so-called passively monitor patients if you have a smartphone app that can monitor how often you sleep and how often you move around and how often you take your meds without you even knowing it. And that raises lots of, you know, privacy issues and issues like that, but a lot of people feel that that's really what we need, because if you want to get accurate data about what people are doing and they're not motivated, it's the only way to do it. And Google, of course, has the power to do something like that. So, on the one hand, very promising. On the other hand, it's a little scary. It's a little Big Brother-ish in some ways.
But there's no reason why, of course, like every other thing we give consent, have to give informed consent to anything before we have a medical procedure, before we sign up to get emails from some stupid commercial website, we have to give informed consent, hopefully without small print. But I would think that as long as the patient was given true, clear, simple explanation and informed consent of what rights are being granted, I think that can be addressed. No, do you buy that?
Yes. I mean, I think that if one can understand the risks and benefits of these things, they're no more harmful than any of the other things that we do in medicine, really.
Exactly. Okay, last thing. Tell us, now, so you've got this website, cyberguide.org, spelled P-S-Y as in psychology, P-S-Y-B-E-R-G-U-I-D-E.org. Tell me why anybody who's listening to the show should visit that, and what's your dream and vision for it down the road?
Right. So CyberGuide is a project of the International Mental Health Research Organization, which is based in the Napa Valley. It's a nonprofit that does a fair amount of mental health advocacy and research. And we came up with the idea that, you know, there's maybe 3,000 or 4,000 apps and products entering the market that claim that they can do something for mental health. And these are not regulated by, say, the FDA or a similar body, and they're not tested in clinical trials. So, you know, some of the people at IMRO who have relatives with mental illness said, well, how do we know what's good and what isn't good? What should we look at? So we decided we would cull from those products the ones that were most attractive and that met certain entry criteria, and we would describe them on our website. We would rate them. We would ask experts to look at them and review them. So a consumer can go on there. Right now we have about 75 products on there, and you can go and you can read about them, you can compare them to others, and if you've used them, you can rate them yourself. And, and we hope someday we will collect a lot of ratings from direct users, and that those data will be combined and be kind of a proxy for clinical trial data. So some will clearly emerge as better than others, and people can just go on there and see that. And we hope, actually our big vision is that someday we will be kind of like the nonprofit accrediting body for apps, just like the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology gives board certification to psychiatrists. We hope we or someone like us will be an accrediting agency for mental health apps, and people will get sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval, you know, by virtue of going through our process.
Sounds great. Now, you say you've got 75 different apps up there. We focus on three that I believe you've touted, you know, fairly highly on your website, but Big White Wall, Mood Kit, and Pacifica. Is there one other app that you feel our listeners should know about that covers either a different space or that we should otherwise mention?
Well, we haven't talked about schizophrenia, for example. There's a very nice app that's produced by the by SARDA, Schizophrenia and Related Disorders Association. And they have an app for schizophrenia on there, which I think is very good. And
what's it called? You have a name for it? Do you know the name by any chance?
I'm kind of embarrassed that I don't have it at the tip of my tongue. I'll look on the website right now while we're talking and find it for you.
People can just Google SARDA, S-A-R-D-A, and schizophrenia app, and I'm sure they'll find it.
Exactly.
Okay. So last thing, I've gotten in the habit of doing this lately. You know, what I do during the week, this is my hobby, this radio show thing. I've been doing it 26 years, but it's still a hobby. My real career is I'm a career counselor, and I like to take my guests, and my guests have been generous in giving me part of their Sunday and sharing so much of their expertise. They don't get paid, you know, like I don't get paid, but I like to give something back to them. So I'd like to ask you a question and invite you to answer it if you feel like it, which is, if you were to raise a question or problem about your own career or next step in your career, obviously you're quite eminent. You're the head of the psychiatry department at Johns Hopkins Medicine Suburban Hospital. You're a distinguished fellow of American Psychiatric Association. You've run in the Cyber Guide, and you've done do other things too. But if there was a question that you might want to get my take on related to your career, what would that be?
Well, with specific reference to CyberGuide, the main challenge for me has been fundraising and getting access to people and convincing them of the mission, because we're a nonprofit, we're having to raise money. And I have to tell you, that's not something that I've been that good at in my career.
So you should So if I said that you should simply outsource that, probably the best, you know, find somebody who is good at writing grants, who maybe has already successfully written mental health grants. And while NIMH is a pain in the ass to try to deal with because it's such a long cycle, but there are foundations that have much shorter cycles that may in fact have, when I think of Charles Schwab, his kid had ADD, he had ADD, and so they fund a lot of special ed stuff. So I imagine somebody could do just a little bit of research to identify 3 or 5 foundations that have a mental health mission and write a simple brief, you know, follow their procedure, usually a one-page letter of inquiry. And if they like the one-page letter of inquiry, then they ask for a full proposal. What if I said that that's what you should do? What feels right and wrong about that if you haven't already done that?
Well, I think I've written more than 20 such grant applications. I've focused on private foundations up to now, and I've been successful in getting 3 of them to contribute. The other 17 said no. And I think, you know, we probably have to go to bigger agencies. I think it's probably good to outsource and get an expert grant writer. But Where we are right now, I think that we've had the greatest success when we have a personal connection to a person in the foundation who likes what we're doing and has a relative that could benefit from this.
Yes.
Those are the people who have so far been interested. But you're right. You know, when we get a little bit bigger, we probably need advice and expertise from people who kind of do this for a living.
Or maybe I'm always respectful of what worked in the past you want to do more of. So what if you hire, you've got either some assistant or somebody who works for you or whatever, do some research to find out rich people who have a relative with special needs, with, you know, mental health issues, and directly write to their manager, their agent, whatever. They could be CEOs, you know, they could be entertainers, whatever. How about trying a little experiment, low-risk experiment, identify five such people, a little bit large enough of a sample size that you've got a chance of testing whether it really works, have them send five letters of inquiry, and see if that yields any results.
That's a great idea, actually. Yeah, I have not approached it from that angle, so it's a very good suggestion.
I'll quit while I'm ahead. Anyway, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. The website, again, is cyberguide, spelled PSYBERGUIDE.org. I'm Michael Knabel. It was a pleasure having you as my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye. And now, as always, we turn to you, my dear listeners. Whatever we do what are called workovers. Whatever your work-related problem, I can usually help, like I tried to help him. I never in a million years thought he was going to ask me about how to raise lots of money for his nonprofit. Happy to do it. Whether you're a clerk, CEO, self-employed, employed by somebody else, whatever, any work-related problem, including, as per my previous guest, mental health issues very often get in the way of career success. Anxiety, depression, whatever. You're anything related or indirectly related, or relationships. I've had so many clients whose relationships have affected their ability to function really well in the work environment. So anything directly or indirectly related to work is fair game for what I call a workover, although there is no pummeling involved, and the price is certainly right, zero, zippo, nada. And the time to call is now before the lines fill up, which they tend to do. The phone number for a workover here on Work with Marty Nemco, KELW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And what I thought I would do while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, there are so many of my clients who have said to me, I hate my boss, or they got fired and they hated their boss, or whatever. And of course, with sitcoms and movies, even the news media highlighting the evils of bosses, it is tempting to place all the blame on those greedy, mean monsters. But my job as a career coach usually requires me to dig beneath what a client, what they call as a contributing complaint, what they come in with. And that can often reveal a more complicated picture. Yeah, there are some bosses who are intrinsically evil or incompetent or lazy. But the fact is that on average, people don't get selected to be the boss at random. On average, they're picked because compared with the average worker bee, they are some combination of smarter, more skilled, harder working, or they're, like to use our mental health continuing the thread, they're more emotionally together. One of the things that I really respect about Barbara, my wife, Barbara Nemco, she is really even-tempered. Nothing throws her. And so, you know, that is part of why she's a successful superintendent, nationally eminent at this point. She's very low maintenance and very together. So, but let's now look at five types of bosses that employees tend to hate. And instead of just writing them off as jerks, which I don't like the word because it always is always used to describe a man, a female boss can be bad or good too. But instead of just writing them off as bad, let's consider why that boss might be behaving the way they do, other than that they're a jerk. There is the angry boss, for example. And yeah, some angry bosses merely are power-hungry hotheads who enjoy managing by intimidation. But there are some angry bosses that have reasons to be angry more often than we might prefer. Even an angry boss isn't angry all the time, but even if they're angry 10% of the time, we call them an angry boss. So might any make believe you're the employee and you have somebody you call an angry boss. Might any of the following apply to your situation that may explain why that person's an angry boss, other than his being or her being a power-hungry hothead who loves managing by intimidation? Maybe simply his or her job is difficult or frustrating. Maybe his or her boss is setting unrealistic expectations and that's putting a lot of pressure. And or maybe Your boss is frustrated by your work group's poor performance or attitude. I have had many clients who are executives and managers, and they are very frustrated sometimes when they can't get rid of their bad workers, but they are lazy and or incompetent. That could make somebody angry if they have any predisposition toward being angry. Or an angry boss could be angry because they have family problems, and the pressure between just even an average job and the family is just too much. Or the reason somebody's boss could be angry could be you. Maybe really, I mean, everybody thinks they're above average. There are studies that show that very few percentage of people think they're below average workers. But by definition, half of people are below average in the quality of work and the quantity of their work. Or, you know, there was a Cornell study that said that, you know, most people are not intelligent enough, most unintelligent people are not smart enough to realize they're unintelligent. So maybe you're thinking you're smarter than you are. Or maybe you are lazy. Well, you rationalize it, but maybe you're perceived, at least, by your boss as lazy. Or that you complain a lot, or that you're absent a lot, or that you're late a lot. So you could be the basis for the anger. Now, of course, if your boss was perfect, he or she would always be like Obama or Kasich, or my wife, like Barbara, complete equanimity rather than like, you know, Donald Trump volatility. But most bosses aren't that good. So my question is, how confident are you that you would be as good as you wish your boss were? If you think it might be worthwhile, take a look inward and ask yourself on a Sunday when you're not pressured by the week's work and everything else, really ask yourself whether you are giving your boss reason for being frustrated with you, or he or she has got other reasons apart from you for being frustrated, which may at least make you a little more tolerant instead of just writing him or her off as bad or a jerk. And if you don't know if the problem is you, most of us don't. We know ourselves sort of, but we don't know ourselves that well. Ask other people for feedback. And if you're concerned they won't be honest, there's this great website, web app that is free called Talent Checkup. You can Google it. You can send them an anonymous talent checkup where you can send 3 to 8 people who are your coworkers asking a few questions about it for honest feedback about you. So that's a way in which you might deal with an angry boss without just simplistically writing him or her off as bad. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and
that
try
person again. I don't think has an awful lot to ask me about. Let's go back. Let's go to the next line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Can you, Marty?
Yes, hello.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure you heard me.
Perfectly.
I'm just laughing because I remembered in Work is Hell, Matt Groening's book, that there are the 9 types of bosses, including the psychotic that says, "How dare you duck when I throw things at you?"
Right.
A really good book that you should definitely go through.
Sounds great.
I'm 58. I've been dealing with a couple of disabilities, and I'm looking to get training, software training, to be a development assistant or development associate. And the challenge is that there are so many other pieces of software that I don't have in place, but this one particular one would be very helpful. I'm looking now at going back to working direct services, and I'm wondering how much the fact that I haven't done it for quite a while is going to work against me in terms of getting interviews, getting employed. I do have disability. I get SSDI, so that I have a floor. So just wanted your thoughts.
Well, it requires a few questions first. The couple of your terms have very different definitions. First of all, tell me about the 3 things I'm going to ask you about so you have an advanced organizer. You said you have a couple of disabilities. It'll help me to know what they are.
2, yeah, chemical sensitivity, diabetes, and just generally not in good physical condition.
Okay. And diabetes sometimes is just physical issues, and sometimes it causes cognitive deficits. Is your diabetes causing cognitive declines, or you're not? And sometimes we don't know it. We're not even aware of it. What is the status of your cognitive functioning given your diabetes?
It's chicken and egg. I think that they're pretty good, but I do know that you know, sometimes like language Language is not, my language skills are not what they were 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Okay. You said the term development associate. That can mean different things. What do you mean by a development associate?
In terms of resource development.
What kind of resource?
Fundraising.
Okay. Development as in fundraising. Okay. Fundraising associate. Got it. So you're talking about software like Razor's Edge or something like that. Is that correct?
Something like that.
Okay, great. And you said direct. You've done direct services. Tell me what direct services you've done and are thinking of doing now.
I was in workforce development, whether job coach, youth employment coordinator, director of job readiness.
Okay. And the software that you've carefully, hopefully, you're right. At this stage, certainly, you want to focus on one critical piece of software that is invaluable to fundraising efforts. Now, again, I happen to know this Razor's Edge, which I believe is the industry standard. Is it, first of all, clear that the piece of software you would like to learn is absolutely in demand in the marketplace?
Yes. I've spoken with, it's being offered through a very reputable training program, JVS.
Oh, yeah, yeah. JVS is a wonderful organization. What is the name of the software for our listeners?
It's Salesforce.
Of course.
The training is Salesforce Administrator. It's a three and a half month training program.
Okay. And great. So Salesforce, of course, is used all over both business and nonprofits. People don't think of nonprofits as businesses, but they're totally businesses. And Salesforce, which is a customer relation management piece of software, is a very dominant piece of software. So JVS is great. Program is great. So we can't guarantee, I'd be less than honest if I said that a guy who's going to be 58 and a half with some cognitive decline, who's a new, brand new software associate or software programmer in a field that tends to be dominated by 18 to 28 year olds, can I say you go boy? I'd be a liar, but I would say that given the JVS is free or low cost, they are known for high quality programs. The software seems great. You need to have a direction anyway. I would absolutely both sign up for it, and if you needed, get supplementary one-on-one tutoring. And even while you're training, I would be starting to talk with employers that you would want to work for. Tell them your dream that you're learning this Salesforce specifically as applied to nonprofit context, and you want to know, you know, what else can you do to make yourself hireable afterwards. So you've built a little bit of a relationship with a few of those nonprofits, maybe their IT director at some on target nonprofit, so that you're then able to, when you finish, you can, first of all, you will have convinced them that you've completed the program, which is great. You're a finisher, and you will have developed a relationship. How are you feeling about that?
That's good. That's really good. I mean, I have some experience in development. Much of it is in kind and day of event activity.
Right.
So, no, I appreciate it, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Let's go back to the phone. Let me give out the phone number again one more time. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem of any sort, really, frankly, the harder the better. I don't think I've ever gotten a problem that I say I can't at least help you take a baby step forward. I don't care if you are curled up with a joint in your bed for the last 4 months and you're suffering from bipolar disorder and you haven't been working for 9 years. And you're quadriplegic, I can usually help you take a step forward. So whatever your problem, or you're a CEO who's a high-powered Fortune 10 biotech CEO, I've helped those clients, a number of my clients are like that. Whatever your problem, whatever your station in life, as they say, to use the radio pun, the phone number here, work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Back to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, Marty. I'm a radiologic technologist.
Yes.
I interviewed for a job at...
Anyway, for those people who don't know what that is, that would be somebody who is an X-ray technician or MRI technician, sonography technician, some subset of imaging.
Exactly.
Continue.
I interviewed for a job working as a dialysis access center, which basically caters to the dialysis community. And I interviewed in the beginning of February, and...
What, a dialysis access center, is that like a Vita or whatever the name of that place is?
It enables the dialysis patient to get dialysis, because what happens is dialysis patients, they develop stenosis or problems related to actually getting proper dialysis. We go in as a dialysis access center. We go in and, like, put in a balloon, open it up,
got
and
it.
Open up the thing. And so what I was interviewing for the one of the DaVita corporations
right.
that has a subset, the AS, an access center that's opening up in San Jose. And I actually worked for DaVita in that same field. The problem is that when I interviewed on February 2nd, I haven't heard anything. So, like, I emailed the regional operation director
sure.
3 weeks later, and she said, you know, asking, is the job been filled? And she said, no. And then, thanks for checking in. I'll keep you posted.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, this is like, you know, beginning of 3 weeks ago. And then last Monday, I did the same thing, and she gave me the same
mm-hmm.
reply that the job hasn't been filled. But through the rumor that I know that the originally was said that the center was going to open up at the end of March, and now I heard that it's going to be opening in the end of April. But see, the problem is that she's not telling me whether I didn't get the job or I got the job.
Okay, your mistake is you're putting too many eggs in one basket, and because there's many things that go on. DaVita or whatever, I see their signs up there. Yeah, they're a huge corporation, and they're bureaucratic, and they, you know, these days they're so afraid of wrongful termination suits, they apply 4 or 5 interviews very often to hire. There are all kinds of detailed background checks. There's all kinds of approvals. Apart from all that, you know, funding approvals, this and that, it's, you can't wait for anyone. Every successful client of mine, generally, not every, but almost everyone, treats an individual job lead as merely one of a dozen leads. The rule of thumb is you need to have a half a dozen balls in the air at one time to have a reasonable chance of getting a job. So you need to either other DaVitas or Kaiser Permanente, which I believe is likely to be one of them, continue to grow, or it's going to be Sutter Health or whatever, you need to identify a half a dozen or a dozen players where you could, you know, you're being an imaging specialist and opening
right.
up the clogged renal pathways.
Right.
You need to not put all your eggs in that basket. You need to do 12 if you haven't already. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemko. I appreciate it. We don't have time to... I guess I will do one more. I was talking about, you know, if you have a bad boss who's supposedly just a jerk or bad, it may not be as simple as that. And I talked about the angry boss. Let me just briefly talk about the micromanaging boss, because it's such common. If a boss micromanages most or all the supervisees, of course, it suggests that the boss... It could be even that that boss is so superior as to justify the micromanagement. But more often, it means that boss fails to recognize the cost of micromanaging, because you're going to demotivate employees, and then there's the opportunity cost, what that micromanaging boss could otherwise be doing with his or her time. But if you are the one being singled out for micromanagement, others are not, it may again be time for you to look inward. For example, without your boss's watchful eye, would your work be of lower quality and quantity? Look inward. So before you write off your boss as a jerk, as too angry, as micromanaging, it may be of value to look inward. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I'm very excited about next week's show, because in addition to workovers, I'm going to talk with somebody about what it's really like to be a cutting-edge scientist. I'm going to talk with a UCSF researcher and the president of the American Society for Human Genetics, Neil Risch. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.